I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of March. I have introduced many people in my radio time, but this guest may have one of the most interesting backgrounds of all of them. Jeffrey Mason is our guest. He's author of a ton of books, but the most recent one is Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. He was raised to become a spiritual leader. He became disillusioned with that, so he became a professor of Sanskrit at the University of Toronto, where he was also trained to become a Freudian analyst. He was projects director of the Freud Archives. He later entered the world and deep interest in animal emotions. And two of his books, When Elephants Weep and Dogs Never Lie About Love, were New York Times bestsellers. He became a vegetarian as a result of this research. He's now a vegan. He lives on a beach in New Zealand with his two sons and his wife, who is a pediatrician who works with children on the autistic spectrum. And of course, he has a lot of animals. And he says that if there's one insight that he feels a reader should take away from this latest book, Beasts, it is that no serious evidence supports the idea that other animals besides humans engage in mass killings of one another. Us versus them is not in our genes. It is something that we learn. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jeffrey. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. He is joining us by phone, I don't think from the beach, but he is joining us by phone from Australia. Hello, Jeffrey. Thank you so much. Or New Zealand, rather. Hello, Jeffrey.
New Zealand. That's right.
Yeah.
Hi, Kathleen. Nice
Hi.
To speak to you. But I am on the beach. We're only 20 feet from the water here.
Oh, Jeffrey, it sounds beautiful. And I hear New Zealand is one of the most, that if you're going to study the animal world and the plant world, New Zealand is the best place in the world.
It's a good choice, yes.
Yeah. You have quite a phenomenal background. It is as though you've lived extraordinarily different lives, isn't it?
You're right. You know, as I hear you say it, I'm a little bit shocked myself, and I sometimes think, gee, am I slowing down now? I don't have a new profession.
But you have a new book, so.
I do, yes.
Yeah. Well, let's start with that very, very big thought, which forms the basis of the book, but the book is fascinating. If there's one thing you should take away, there is no serious evidence supporting the idea that any other animals except humans engage in mass killings of one another. That's true,
That's
huh?
That's right.
Wow.
That is true, and you know, in a sense, people know it, but it's not been commented upon very much, and it certainly hasn't been studied. And I think we need to take that into account when trying to distinguish between humans and other animals. We've always used the term "he's an animal" or "a beast" in a negative way, and I think we really need to think that maybe we're the beast.
Yeah, we've killed how many of our own?
Well, in the 20th century alone, it's over 200 million.
Wow.
I got that figure from my best friend Daniel Ellsberg when we were sitting down and talking about this book, which is one of the reasons I dedicated it to him and to my family, because he's been, of course, very concerned with mass killings and with possibility of nuclear winter and so on. And so we sat down to talk about animals, and he was astonished to learn that they don't do that. And so he said, by the time I finish your book, Jeff, I decided to become a vegetarian. I thought that was very cool.
Oh, did he really? Well, I would
imagine. He did. He announced it publicly. I was so pleased.
Oh, I imagine. And you've gone beyond vegetarianism.
I have. I don't eat any animal product at all.
And we'll talk about why in a little while. I saw this marvelous play in Milwaukee. Unfortunately, the ending of it was last Sunday, but it was the Iliad, and it was a virtuoso performance by Jim DeVita, who's a well-known Wisconsin actor. But at one point, he lists all of the wars that have taken place since the Trojans and, you know, since Homer's reciting of the Iliad. And I've got to tell you, Jeffrey, he went on for a good 7 minutes, one after another, rapid fire.
Yeah, good. That's exactly what got me. I mean, that's really scary. There are a number of books that do that, you know, that just simply recount what we've done to one another, and it's really quite shocking. And we kind of have to turn our minds off that if we want to even, you know, go about our daily business. But from time to time, it's good to be reminded and try and understand why.
Right. Why is it, you write, that humans seem to have a mania for hierarchy, which inevitably signals the wish to dominate another? And indeed, we do in so many ways. Why do we have a mania for hierarchy?
Well, it's a good question. I don't think we're born with it. I don't think it's inborn. I mean, a number of animals, wolves, for example, have hierarchies. The gorillas, all kinds of animals have it. But it doesn't seem to lead to the same kind of violence that it does in our case. And we're the only ones, you know, I think a lot about dogs, because, of course, I've always had dogs in my life. And, you know, if you're driving in a car with a dog and they've got their head out the window and suddenly it's like, stop, stop. What is it? I see another dog. You know, they want you to stop so they can meet and greet and play.
Right.
Their first thought is night. Oh, you know, there's a dog. He doesn't look like me. He's not the same color,
right.
Not the same size, doesn't have the same clothes. That's it for him. He's toast. They don't do that, you know. For dogs, all dogs are dogs. And we can't do that. You know, we make these distinctions based on religion, on color, on ethnicity, on language, on class, on income. I mean, it's just infinite how we can distinguish ourselves from others, and not just distinguish because it's nice to know we're different, but distinguish so that we can, as you said, dominate or harm or in some way behave as if the other is not worthy of respect.
Yeah.
And can even be killed. That's the real problem.
Right.
It's not just avoiding them. It's wanting to destroy them.
Well, I share your love of dogs, so we'll get back to dogs in a moment. But let's talk about sort of the ultimate in this domination. And you write about it a little bit in your book, but I was interested in more of your thoughts about slavery and how long it has existed and how we fought a civil war in America over this issue. So many people died.
Yes, yes. I've been thinking about it since. You're right. I didn't talk about it as much as I should have, because it is kind of the dominant paradigm for the us-them. And this is what intrigued me recently. There is a very good book of Inhuman Bondage on the history of slavery by David Bryan. What is his last name? David is his last name. And he started the Lehrman Center at Yale University to study of slavery. And he's just finished his magnum opus, 35 or 40 years in the making, three volumes on the history of slavery. And he talks about the fact that he recognizes now that the idea for slavery came from the domestication of animals, not cats and dogs, but every other animal, the farm animals, you know, cows, pigs, chickens, ducks, geese, and so on. And he thinks that almost everything that we got from the idea of capturing somebody and enslaving them and putting manacles on them and branding them and using a whip comes from the way we treated animals. Now, he doesn't raise the question of why it was okay to do to animals in the first place, but I think that's the next question. Of course, it's a horrible thing to do to a human being, but it's also a terrible thing to do to an animal. And I think doing it to an animal gave us the idea that it was okay to do to another being, especially if you could convince yourself that that other being was lower in some way than you.
Yeah. Well, I think you cite, which I found fascinating, information of how much longer we lived and bigger as human beings we were before we started domesticating animals. When we were hunters and gatherers, we were evidently healthier people.
Well, that's right. That came as a surprise to me. I got that first from Jared Diamond, who talks about it, but I see that he got it from a variety of other sources, and apparently it's well known in the field of anthropological nutrition, you know, scholars who study ancient humans in terms of what we were eating and what happened. And actually, it makes sense if you think about it, because when we were hunter-gatherers and wandering around in the forest, we were eating up to 300 different kinds of foods on a daily basis, because we had to eat whatever we could find. Once we started domesticating plants and then animals, our diet became much more restricted. We were eating three, four, five, six different things, not the hundreds we did before. So we weren't getting trace minerals. We weren't getting the nutrients that were in the earth and in all these fruits and vegetables. And our health suffered and still does, I think, to this day.
Mm-hmm. You were raised to be as a vegetarian, weren't you?
That's right. My parents were vegetarians because they were involved with an Indian-like guru, a man by the name of Paul Brunt. Actually, he was an English journalist, but he lived in India for some time with the Maharaja of Mysore, and he was persuaded that I was going to become his successor.
Oh, my
gosh.
So he
lived with us. Yeah, it was a terrible thing to do to a young boy. But, of course, it was also fascinating at the time, and as gurus go, he was pretty benign. I wrote a book about him called My Father's Guru. I'm not fond of any gurus, but he didn't do me all that much harm.
Yeah, I really haven't known any, so I wouldn't be able to make any kind of comparison. What a life you've had. It's amazing. So the domestication of animals really changed us. You know, obviously, it's the way a lot of the world is going here. How would the world be different, do you think, if we returned to the kind of diet that you eat?
Well, for one thing, I think if we did that, we would be able to feed everybody on Earth. And that's a major plus. We would not have world hunger. There's no question about it. I mean, more and more people who are not the least bit interested in animals or veganism as an ethical choice recognize that. I mean, even Al Gore recently tried becoming vegan and decided, I'm going to stick with this for reasons having to do with the environment, because we use so much water, so much land to feed cattle, which we then feed to ourselves just to make us sick, that it really doesn't make sense. So people are giving it up in droves. I was amazed. I just came back from a book tour in the United States, and I was surprised and delighted to see how many new vegetarian and vegan restaurants there are everywhere I went. And the number of people who are choosing that because it is the sensible thing to do really surprised me.
Hmm. And if domination is one of our problems and leads us to killing other human beings, does it also logically make sense then, if we change the diet and we are no longer domesticating animals, that we would have, or is this a stretch, fewer wars, fewer acts of violence?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Would probably require another book. I don't make that claim in my book because it is, I mean, it's very interesting to think about that. Is that a possibility? Yes, I think it is, but it's not something that would happen overnight. And people can be certainly, I've known many vegetarians who are not particularly ethical, except in that area, who can be cruel. And I've known many people who eat meat who can be very kind to other people. So it doesn't automatically follow. But I think it is something that, over time, as we become used to simply destroying other beings, we get used to it. I've noticed that a lot. In some of the books I don't like, they will talk about the fact, I'm not a great fan, as you might imagine, of The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan. But at one point he describes how he went to kill chickens, and he found it very distasteful. But he said the man next to me had been doing it for years, and he didn't seem to mind. Well, I mean, the conclusion to draw from that is that we become coarsened. You know, we become used to inflicting suffering on other people or other beings simply by doing it all the time. It's not something to strive for. It's something we want to try and avoid. We don't want to become desensitized to harm.
Mm-hmm. And you've had personal experience with chickens with their fabulous personalities, right?
Oh, they're just marvelous beings. I wrote a little book called Raising the Peaceable Kingdom, in which I, here on the beach, we had young chicks who became chickens. It turned out one was a rooster. We didn't know that at first. Very hard to sex a chicken. It turned out to be a rooster, and they absolutely refused to be anywhere except where I was.
Aww.
So if I was writing my book, they wanted to sit there right on the table and stare at the computer, look from the screen, look back at me. When we went up for a walk on the beach, they insisted on coming. They were friends with the rabbit, with the dogs, with the cats. They were, you know, they were exactly like dogs and cats, actually. Very playful, a lot of fun to be around, and complex creatures. And the idea of killing one and eating it was just horrifying to me as you get to know them.
Right.
And you realize they're beings with personalities. They're persons.
Yeah. I'll have to get to know them better. You start the book, however, and I wondered, because you've obviously lived with a lot of different kinds of animals and studied the animal kingdom pretty carefully, but you start the book with crocodiles and this pretty, you know, hard story about a crocodile and a human being.
Yeah, that is an amazing story.
Why did you start with crocodiles?
Well, I guess because I was thinking at first of calling the book Apex Predators. So these are the top predators on the planet.
Uh-huh.
And there are probably eight of them. Well, there are more. There are a couple hundred. But we often think of bears and wolves and great white and crocodiles and orcas and the big cats and humans as the top predators on Earth. That is, in their particular niche, no animal will prey upon a healthy animal of that species.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, you know, we're like some of them, but we're not like others. And I grew up with the same prejudices that everybody else. You know, don't bother a crocodile. Don't bother a great white. They don't care about us at all. We're just prey to them. In fact, we're not prey to them because they evolved long before humans were on Earth, and they're not used to eating us. They will occasionally do so. But my thesis became, and I'm not sure this is true, but it's fascinating to think about, that the reason that crocodiles attack us is because we've attacked them.
Mm.
In fact, when you think about it, we kill over 1 million crocodiles every year. We farm them for their skin. And crocodiles kill maybe 4 or 5 humans a year.
Hmm.
So that's a huge difference there. They kill 4 or 5, we kill 1 million of them. And not out of vengeance, just because we can. And then I found evidence that there are some crocodiles living in the deserts around these oases in Mauritania, for example, who share a water hole with humans. And some German researchers were there recently and found children playing in these ponds and women doing the washing. And on the other side were crocodiles sunning themselves. And when they asked, they said, well, we have a belief that if we ever harm the crocodile, our water will dry up.
Oh my.
So we have never, ever harmed a crocodile. And no crocodile has ever harmed us. So it's as if they recognize, okay, let's make a pact. You don't harm us, we don't harm you.
Hmm. But you haven't gone so far as to swim with crocodiles yourself.
No, I would not, especially in Australia, where a lot of them exist. When I see a sign, do not enter this billabong, which is the Aboriginal word for a pond, because they're crocodiles, I stay out.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about wolves for a while. There is still a controversy about the killing of wolves in the state of Wisconsin. When we think about wolves and other animals, too, you write that we think that, you know, they're nasty, that they kill us, that we have to stay away from them. But what you said earlier about wolves and dogs certainly don't track down wolves who have the wrong color. There are no murderous generals around wolves. We've given them a bad rap, wolves.
Yes, we have. I mean, just think of some of the terms. Man is a wolf to man.
Right.
And I just saw in the New York Times the other day, what have we become, wolves?
Mm.
And I was thinking, gee, that would be nice if we did. How wonderful if men could behave like wolves. I mean, they're generally peaceable. They mind their own business, extremely shy around humans because they're smart enough to realize that we have tried and often succeeded in completely eradicating them or exterminating them. Because of a bad rap we've given them, which is totally undeserved. You know, in Norway, this always shocked me when I read this, in Norway, where the wolf has been exterminated for the last 200 years, they had a survey recently where they asked adults what most frightened them in the world, and 50% said they were most frightened of wolves.
No.
Yes, and that's astonishing. They haven't even seen a wolf. And, of course, even great wolf researchers agree that it's almost impossible to see them. They're so shy, so frightened of humans, that it's rare that you even catch a glimpse of them. And you remember that silly film, The Grey,
right?
With Liam Neeson, where wolves are hunting humans. I mean, that's simply preposterous. It's just not real.
Yeah. So where do we get those myths, and why do we have them? Why do we perpetuate them?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question. Probably, I tell you, there's a new book called Man the Hunted. And I think there was a time in our very early evolutionary history where we were hunted by other predators, and the big cats, especially leopards and so on. Now that's very rare. But in fact, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because it makes me wonder if one of the reasons that cats and dogs sometimes seem to be inimical to one another is because there was a period when we were living with dogs, and the dogs were taken by big cats, by leopards, and they just can't get over it. So they still bear a grudge. But, you know, we have been. I mean, I think in our evolutionary past, there were eagles that killed humans, or the big cats, probably even dire wolves, you know, large wolves at the time, saber-toothed tigers and so on. And as we became ourselves apex predators, they left us alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there may be some memory of that in the species. But, you know, I notice some people, for example, are very frightened of spiders and snakes. I'm not. And I guess, you know, people are divided in that. But I don't find snakes and spiders the least bit frightening. But some people who've never seen them are still frightened of them, including children. So it's as if it's born into us.
Mm-hmm.
But to lead from being frightened to becoming an enemy, that's the step I don't get. Why do we have to eradicate them, especially when we know that most of these animals mean us and do us no harm whatsoever?
We go to phone calls in just a moment, and our guest this hour is Jeffrey Mason. His latest book, he's written several of them, is Beasts, What Animals Can Tell Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. It's a good title, huh? And the book covers, as you can tell from our conversations so far, so much. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Jeffrey is joining us by phone from just off the beach in New Zealand. He's a former psychoanalyst, former director of the Freud Archives, and is the author of a number of other books, including When Elephants Weep and Dogs Never Lie About Love. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeffrey Mason, our guest, and his latest book is Beasts, What Animals Can Tell Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. And we go to phone calls, the first of many, Nathan in Horicon. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine, how are you?
Good. It seems to me that humans are kind of more susceptible to cultural and societal pressures than animals, but there must be some kind of animals that do kill other ones, maybe mentally ill animals or something like that. And I was just wondering if you thought that kind of the propagation of mental illness kind of causes our willingness to kill, or even more susceptible to being changed by culture or something like that, you know? Do you see that in animals, I guess, is my question.
Okay.
Okay, it's an interesting question. I wanted to write a book called Crazy Like a Fox, which would be why there's no such thing as mental illness in the wild. And it did occur to me that it's something very rare. And when you do find it, there's a very interesting book called Elephants on the Edge by Gay Bradshaw. And she looked at some adolescent male elephants in southern Africa who were murdering rhinoceroses. And she found that's not something you normally see elephants do. So she was very curious about this and came up with this absolutely brilliant, well, it's not even a hypothesis, it's now absolutely certain, that these elephants had seen their mothers slaughtered in front of their eyes and had been traumatized by this and then had been orphaned and didn't belong to any elephant society, did not know how to behave. So in your caller's eyes, they would be called mentally ill. They were certainly psychopathic teenage elephants, and they started killing. So in that, you know, and if you analogize from that and think about humans, it could well be that humans who become psychopaths or humans who become mentally ill, not a term I generally use, but I can understand why your caller would use it, you could hypothesize that those people have been subjected to trauma, usually early trauma, that disturbs their sense of self, that disturbs their ability to blend into society and be a, quote, normal member. So I suspect that almost every time you find someone behaving very oddly, they are responding to trauma, whether a human or an animal. Now, the question would then be, is it possible that our entire species has suffered severe trauma? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, and it's certainly true. You write a lot about habitat and humans encroaching on the natural habitat of a number of other species that can change their behavior. If your habitat is gone, you don't have access to your food.
Oh,
your whole structure
is changed. I'm so glad you brought that up, Kathleen, because this is becoming a matter of great concern. I just saw a terrific article by the Center for Biological Diversity talking about the fact that we eat so much meat means that we are causing extinction, because as we take over more and more land that was normally part of the habitat of wild animals, they come into conflict with us, with other animals, and sometimes starve to death. So that we are creating extinctions here simply out of appetite. And that's brand new. That's not something we recognized even a few years ago.
Yeah. Josie is next in Sheboygan. Hi, Josie.
Oh, good afternoon. I just love you, Mr. Mason. I'm 69 years old, and I've loved animals since I was born. And I've been ridiculed in my lifetime, saying, how come you love them more than people? You know, all the things you can think of, the cliches. And the destruction, there's just, I could talk to you for hours on the cruelty of man, you know, to each other and to, but especially to animals, you know, like drilling these huge nails in dolphins' heads, clubbing baby seals, killing elephants, slaughtering them for their tusks, you know, and just on and on, factory farms. I wanted to ask you this one question. You know, I have pets. And how do you not contribute to the cruelty? Because pets, you know, cats and dogs have to have certain proteins and all that so that they don't get sick and die. And you have to buy meat products, you know, and I,
all right, what do you do about that? What do you do about feeding your, you have cats and dogs?
Well, actually, you know, I've changed my mind about this. I used to, almost every lecture, somebody will ask me, do you feed your cats and dogs meat? And my answer was yes, because they are what we call obligate carnivores. That is, they're obliged to eat meat for their health. But I've since discovered that I'm wrong about that. Oh. I haven't changed my behavior, but I probably should. There's a wonderful book called Obligate Carnivore, I think it's with a question mark, and I can't remember the name of the author, but you'll find it very easily. And he makes the point that it's very easy. I mean, my dog, for example, would love to live on avocados and bananas. He just loves fruit. He's a fruitarian. He really is. He sits under the avocado tree in our yard and waits for an avocado to fall so he can gobble it up. Cats is a little bit more complicated. They have to have taurine, which you have to make sure they get. But it can be done, and there are good reasons to do it. And from an ethical point of view, it certainly makes sense. I don't do it partly because I'm lazy, partly because it's inconvenient, and partly because there is a nagging feeling. I did try it with my cats, and they looked at me like I was suddenly their enemy. They walked away from the food. I left it for 3 days. They starved themselves for 3 days. I gave in. Okay, you win. Right. But certainly if you start when they're kittens, you can feed them a very healthy vegan diet. There's no problem with that.
Thanks, Josie. Well, you've brought up dogs a couple times, so let's move into one of my favorite subjects in the whole world. And I guess I read in your book, and I hadn't thought about this before, it's fairly profound that dogs are the only beings who will give up their lives for human beings. Is that true?
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. I hadn't thought about that for a little while, but you're absolutely right. I don't think I've heard once in a while of a cat doing that. There was a case where an old man jumped out of his window. He was so depressed, and the cat followed him.
Oh.
His cat that had lived with him for 20 years flew out the window, did not die. The man died, but the cat was taken to the vet, and my sister had the same vet. That's how I know about it, and she was in there when this happened, and the vet said, I've never seen anything like that. This cat was definitely trying to kill himself out of loss. You know, he couldn't bear. So it happens, but dogs do it routinely. I mean, they really are the only animal that will sacrifice themselves for their human companion. And, by the way, we do return the favor. There are humans who would risk their lives to save their dogs. So you have this incredibly intimate bond between a dog and a human that is unparalleled in nature. It's the only time, I think, where two species are so connected to one another, you can almost see them as a single species. You know, I've often said, what do dogs think of us? Who do they think we are? I think the answer is they think we're dogs.
That's a great answer. And how did it come about? Did they help us? I mean, I've read that they've helped us with our survival, certainly.
Well, they did. I mean, there's new evidence now, very new. I mean, the last couple of months, there's been a whole slew of new research indicating that dogs have been around with us for at least 35,000 years.
Goodness.
So far longer, far, far longer, at least three or four times as long as any other animal. And it was not something, we didn't force them. They chose this. So they self-domesticated. And in fact, there's even a suggestion that they tried to domesticate us to make us a less violent species, to make us more juvenile the way we want dogs to be more playful, more friendly, more gentle. But the service they were probably providing at the very beginning was they were sentinels. And they still are. They're very, very good. You know, any dog, I mean, there's hardly any dog in the world who doesn't like to sit in front of your door,
right,
making sure that, you know, he lets you know what's happening outside.
Right.
And I have this very gentle golden lab who was a guide dog and failed because he was just too gentle. But even he, if a stranger comes to the door, he woof, 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 and lets me know, wants me to run down and see. And when I say it's fine, then he wags his tail and he licks them. So they've always, when we were living in caves, they were undoubtedly sitting right at the front of the cave warning us if anybody came that wanted to harm us. So that was their first service to us, and they still do it.
Isn't it remarkable, though, that of all the species on Earth, it's dogs and maybe the occasional cat who would give up a life for us? I mean, that's quite something.
It is something. How do you explain it, Kathleen? I mean, it's a deep mystery, isn't it?
I know it is. I don't know.
And it's a wonderful mystery because, you know, people feel this very deeply. And there's nothing worse, of course, than the death of a dog or cat who's lived with you for many, many years. And, you know, you think, my God, you know, they have this short life. It's not fair. And a lot of that life is spent just waiting for us to come home. Not cats, but dogs.
And then being the happiest thing in the whole room to see you every single day.
Well, even if you're gone for 5 minutes, I'm very happy to see you come back. You're back.
I can't live without him. I mean, I'm getting old, and I've only been maybe 4 years of my life without a dog. I love dogs.
Yeah, same with me. I'm getting old, too, but I can't be without a dog.
I'm with you. Judy in Grand Marsh. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thank you so much. I loved your book, Dogs Never Lie About Love. So I want to express that, and I'd love to mention parts that I loved especially, but I hate to be wrong. I've read about 50 books in this 5 months of winter, and I'm getting them sometimes mixed up. So I want you to think of me with sitting here with my ears are perked up.
Okay.
I'm shaking all over. My tail is wagging, and I'm smiling. My tongue is hanging out. So I'm expressing in the lack of mental memory and verbal talents, but I'm looking just like a happy dog.
Oh, Judy,
that I think
that.
Every dog you've ever known must feel. Thank you so much.
Oh, that was
That's
terrific.
Lovely. Thank you so much for
that.
Yeah,
very, very nice. Thanks, Judy. We, by the way, our phone lines have been busy. If you want to join our conversation, we'd love to have you do that. The author of Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil, Jeffrey Mason, is our guest. And you can imagine Jeffrey on the beach of New Zealand in his house with his animals because that is where he is. Let's go to our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. All right, Jeffrey, Peter from email wants you to comment on chimps. They are known to divide into warring tribes and attack and even kill each other. They have been observed attacking healthy members of their species.
Yes, that's true. I do. I talk about it quite a bit in the book because it is the counterexample to my main thesis. But I think my point would be that we do this on a massive scale. There is no parallel to this in the animal world, not even close among chimps. I mean, I think I give the exact number. I think there have been something like 24 incidents that have been described, and we simply can't compare this. Now, there could be more that goes on that we don't know about. And ultimately, you know, we do have to wonder, are we, since we are a primate, are we in any way similar to chimps, or are we more like bonobos, who are also very close to us genetically and who never engage in any kind of violent behavior, possibly because they form these female coalitions and no male would ever dare disturb these because 5 or 6 females just give him the look and they back down immediately. But they're remarkably peaceable animals. They're very promiscuous, but they don't harm other animals. They don't eat other animals. They don't harm one another. And they're closer to us genetically than even chimps. Now, you know that Jane Goodall, who was the first to recognize violence among chimps, asked herself not that long ago whether she may not have played a role in this by provisioning some chimps with bananas. And that raises this question of, did we as a species suddenly discover greed once we started agriculture and animal domestication? Because instead of now wandering around the forest looking for things to eat, we could capture things and keep them next to us and do the same with food. And did that make us greedy and feel, well, we want more than we have, that person shouldn't have so much? You know, greed seems to me, the greed for power, the greed for more possessions, seems to me a very terrible thing that's there, you know. It's still there. I mean, we see it on Wall Street, and we see that it is destroying our world. And I think it did have a beginning. We were not as hunter-gatherers. I'm sure the word itself didn't even exist 40,000 years ago. Nobody said, he's greedy, because everybody was the same. You're wandering around, and you find a tuber or a nut, and you're happy with it.
We welcome our phone calls in a moment. Our guest this hour is Jeffrey Mason. His book is Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeffrey Mason, author of Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil, is our delightful guest this hour. We go to Jim next in Eau Claire. Hi, Jim.
Thank you.
Go right ahead.
Well, I won't say anything that would be disrespectful. You're a great author. I haven't read your books. I can totally respect that. But I've lived on a farm all my life, and animals have to coexist with each other. You know, I'm not going to become a vegetarian because of I have canine teeth. I eat meat. We've lived together from the beginning of time on this earth, and I can't believe that humans become more mean or vicious because of animals or some of the things you're saying. I guess I just disagree with some of it. I'd like to see more proof of this coexistence that animals cause us to be mean.
Well, you know, what I was referring to is the fact that for at least, let's say we've been around as a modern species for 50,000 years. For 40,000 of those years, we did, as you say, coexist with other animals. We occasionally ate them. But we didn't do what we did with the beginnings of domestication about 10,000 years ago, that is, capture them and keep them in such a way that they could no longer, they had no freedom whatsoever of movement. They lost all their choice. They were there simply to be exploited. We wanted to take their meat. We wanted to take their eggs. We wanted to take their milk. We wanted to take their children. We wanted to take their flesh, of course, their skin. And we made it easy for ourselves. And I think that put a seed into our minds of how we could become more greedy, of how could we could become more cruel. That's not to say that they're not people who coexist with animals on farms and don't feel vicious toward them and don't want to hurt them. But if you think about the logic of it, it inevitably leads that the kindest farm with animals leads us eventually to a factory farm. That's the logic of the economics of it. And that's the problem, is that we eventually wind up harming them on a massive scale. But even on a small farm, you'll have to admit, I'm sure, that no matter how much you love your pig or your chicken or your goat, sooner or later you have to kill that animal. And I think that's a mistake. I don't think we have to do that. I think we need to get away from the belief that in order to live, we need to kill. That's simply not true.
Well, with that being said, I guess I look at it one thing. I don't name my animal and then eat it the next day. I've learned to kind of avoid that. And yes, you're separating
right.
yourself.
Right. There you go. You put your finger on it. We have to avoid seeing them as an individual in order to do the harm to them that we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We agree on that.
Thank you, Jim, very much for your call. I appreciate it. Did you say this or did somebody else say this, that humans did evolve primarily as herbivores? Do we know this? Because we have small mouths, we have flattened teeth, and we have long, small intestines.
Well, that's true. I mean, the one thing that Jim said that was not true is, look, I have canines just like my dog. No, you open your dog's mouth and you will see a whole different set of teeth.
Right.
I do that a lot with my very gentle golden lab. I lift up his lips and you see this massive
right.
jaw with these giant teeth. And you think, my God, good thing he likes me. We're not like that. No, I think the evidence is pretty clear. We're much more like herbivores than we are like carnivores.
Huh.
I mean, we are omnivores. That is, we get to choose what we eat. In
right.
fact, we're the only animal in the whole animal world that says, I can eat what I want to eat. Every other animal eats what every other animal eats. We get to choose.
Hmm. Rod is our next caller. Hi, Rod.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Kathleen. To me, there's no question that there's something that sense that the animals have that we don't have. To me, there's no doubt. Because it's just like on our dairy farm, you know, it was like we had 30 dairy cows, and it's like you almost like the cow. It was just like there was a. They knew. They could read your mind. I don't know. It was weird. It's hard to explain. But and horses the same way. My dad was telling about working with horses, and of course, his dad, when one horse was old. And it wasn't going to work anymore. He could not send it to the, what do you call it?
The glue factory.
To be butchered.
Well,
yeah, he couldn't
him.
Do it.
Good
he,
for
that
him.
Was going to live his life out in the pasture.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't, he couldn't do it.
Mm.
And I had an experience with my own cat one time. I had a feeling like, I don't know what the heck it was. I listened to Coast, by the way, to paranormal and stuff. And I had this feeling like there was a, evil or something, and it was like we're all sitting around watching the TV, my nephew and parents, anyhow, the cat, it was like when the ceiling hit the cat, it jumped up and its eyes got big and looked at me, and nobody else knew anything, and this cat looked and it just ran away, and then he stopped. It was my pet, you know, kind of,
but
he's looking, and it was like there was something he knew.
I would imagine.
That's so interesting. You know, when you, by mistake, I mean, you realize that cats and dogs are really wild animals. If you ever make a mistake and you step on their foot or something, and the dog will stare at you in horror for a second as if, oh, my God, am I prey and is he a predator?
Mm.
And then realize, oh, no, it's you. And they come over and lick your hand to show you no ill feelings. You know, I realize you made a mistake. But in that one second, you become aware of how terrifying it must be for a pig or a sheep or a cow or a goat to realize they're going to have their throat slit by the person whom they regarded as their friend or their protector. I mean, it's a horrible thing, and that's why, just like your dad couldn't do it with the horse, I think there are many people on farms who say, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rod, for the call. Email from Lee, who wanted to know what you learned from the book, The Most Dangerous Animal by David Livingston Smith. Man is how he is due to a basic unconsciousness regarding themselves as a living, breathing individual. People have lost feeling-based understanding of what this means. They don't realize that they are breathing, which is the ingredient deserving conscious attention.
Yeah, I mean, look, the thing is, the ultimate desire of every living being is to go on living. Nobody wants to die, yeah. And that's as true of every animal as it is of every human. Now, the puzzle, you know, you began by saying, why do we kill 200 million? Contrasted with that are orcas, which is how I got interested in this topic, because orcas, I've discovered by talking to a number of orca researchers, as far as any orca researcher knows, no orca, the killer whale, has ever killed another orca in the wild.
Mm.
So they've solved this problem. They eat what they need to eat, and that's often, I mean, they can eat polar bears. They're that big and that powerful. But they do not harm one another. And they have never killed a human being in the wild either. So in some sense, I think we could almost say that orcas are more evolved morally than humans.
Hmm. Interesting. What do you make, I don't think this is in the book, but I think you wrote a blog recently. This story really made so many people upset.
Marius, that, right?
What's that? What you go?
Marius, the giraffe.
How did you know that's where I was going?
I, yes. I could just tell it, Kathleen. I read your mind.
Yes, you did. Well, go ahead. It was a very disturbing story.
It really was. You know, it's the only time I've ever written a blog that quotes, you know, I hate that phrase, but it applied to me, and I loved it. Went viral. Suddenly, you know, 1 million people had seen this blog. But that's because people were so interested in what had happened to this giraffe, and it just breaks your heart. Here was this gentle being, and they decided he didn't have the right genes, so they were going to kill him. Perfectly healthy giraffe. And they did it in such a way that his favorite keeper was there feeding him his favorite food. He lowered his gentle neck to this man, and they shot him in the head, killed him, decapitated him, skinned him, and fed him. Now, there we go.
There's somebody at the door.
Somebody just arrived at the door. I have to move away from the door.
Okay.
And fed him to the lions. And everybody with children watching, they said, oh, this is a great opportunity to learn about the realities of life. What reality? You don't kill your friends. That's not real. And then yesterday, I'm sure you read this now, they did the same thing again with four lions. They had six lions, and four of them they decided were of no use to them because they had a new male lion, two new male lions coming in. So they killed them.
Mm.
And people are just appalled at this. And I'm glad that people are appalled because and people are refusing to go to the Denmark Zoo, which they should well do. I would never go to any zoo, but that's one of the worst because of what they've done. And I think it's good to see that people care about these issues. They don't want to see animals killed for no good reason. And there never is a good reason.
Yeah. And then the other thing was that the story came from Denmark, where they saved so many Jews during World War II.
It really bothered me. Always, I've been totally fascinated by that topic of the Danes saving the Jews.
Yes.
I've read everything there is to read on that. It's just every time I read about it, it makes me cry. There's a brand new book on it. Really wonderful book about that. And you think, God, what a wonderful people. And then they do this.
Yeah, I know.
And it makes you wonder, how can that be? What happens to people?
Yeah, I know.
And I'll tell you, they learned a lesson. Well, you think they would have learned a lesson because the response was so visceral.
Right.
And so huge. I mean, just everyone around the world was appalled by this.
Yeah, they sure were. Well, you're delightful. Thank you so much. I was wondering what you were going to be like as I was reading your book. I really wondered, and you were just charming, too. So easy to talk to.
Well, so are you, Kathleen. This is one of my best interviews. I've really enjoyed talking to you. It's such a pleasure when somebody is like you, well-informed, polite, engaging, and interested. It makes all the difference.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I think I'll retire. No, neither one will yet. Thank you, Jeffrey. Jeffrey Mason, our guest. The book is Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. Jeffrey is a really interesting man. You heard him say at the beginning he was, they thought, born to become a new guru. His parents had followed this guru who lived in their house, I think in Chicago. He was born in Chicago. And he went on to study psychoanalysis. He became a psychoanalyst and former director of the Freud Archives, and he's been paying very careful attention to the world around us and the animals around us. He's written a couple books, Dogs Never Lie About Love and Why Elephants Weep, and his latest book, Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil. It's Jeffrey, I'll spell his middle name, M-O-U-S-S-A-I-E-F-F. And his last name is Mason, M-A-S-S-O-N. Well, that was fun, wasn't it? Thanks to K.P. Whaley for doing on-air production. Thanks to Marika Suval for on-air production, or for producing the program, and K.P. for doing all the on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, although I felt as though I was whisked away to the beach in New Zealand for at least an hour this afternoon, which was good. We aren't going to be here tomorrow because we're doing an ascertainment session, so our show will be on tape. To tell you the truth, I'm not sure what the shows are, but you ought to listen to them, whatever in the world they are, tomorrow from 1 until 3. We'll be with you again for all things political coming up on Monday. Thanks for listening, and thank you for calling.